Welcome to Maintain a Rage, a weekly review of Australian politics and current affairs, placed in a historical context so that we understand the sort of things that are occurring today and why they are occurring. Michael Lavarch is my name, and I'm joined, as always, by our producer, Larissa Berendt.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, Larissa. This week we'll be discussing a new coined phrase in terms of Australian economic theory, economic Hansenism. It came into the mainstream this week as a result of competing speeches delivered by Prime Minister Julia Gillard to the Australian Industry Group, and then a few days later a speech delivered by opposition leader Tony Abbott on the memorial of Alfred Deakin, one of the great liberals of Australian political history and one of the great founders of Australian Federation. In her speech, Prime Minister Gillard spoke about the challenges facing Australia, in terms of its economic challenges at least, and made a comment, and I quote from her, "If a strain of economic Hansenism takes hold on the conservative side of politics in a parliament which is so finely balanced, our long-term prosperity is at real risk." And this was in the context of a speech which looked at the big challenges in terms of productivity, employment growth, the rollout of the national broadband network, taxation reform, and a range of other economic issues. And she was pointing to some statements from Shadow Treasurer Joe Hockey and Shadow Finance Minister Andrew Robb, which she argued was suggesting that the national government should re-enter into direct regulation of some key aspects of the Australian economy, namely the way in which banks set their interest rates, or in the case of the Shadow Finance Minister, whether the Australian dollar should be allowed to appreciate as it has in recent weeks against the American dollar, and whether there should be some pullback from the idea of floating exchange rate. Of course, her comments were roundly criticised by the opposition, who said they were making no such claims at all. And Tony Abbott countered with his own claim of economic Hansenism in terms of the Gillard government, particularly in its attitude to rolling out the national broadband scheme without there being a full cost-benefit analysis undertaken, and generally their failure, according to the opposition, to pursue deep tax reform flowing from the review undertaken of the tax system by the Treasury Secretary, Ken Henry. So what is this phrase, economic Hansenism? We'll be exploring that a little bit today. The term obviously relates to one Pauline Hanson, who graced the Australian political stage during the 1990s and then into the first part of the current century. Pauline Hanson, let us just briefly recap about her history, what her philosophy, if you can describe it at that, actually was, and what economic Hansenism might mean. Pauline was endorsed as the Liberal Party candidate for the Queensland seat of Oxley in the 1996 federal election. Shortly before the actual conduct of the election, she was disendorsed by the Liberal Party based on comments she made about government funding programs targeting Aboriginal disadvantage. Essentially, she was making an argument that programs of this sort weren't available to, in inverted commas, ordinary Australians, and reflected a political correctness that had run mad in the Australian political system in terms of special benefits being paid to Aboriginal people. The Liberal Party rejected her statements. They disendorsed her, It was too late to change the nomination of the candidate. Nominations had already closed. So she remained on the ballot paper, indeed, on the ballot paper as a nominated Liberal candidate for that election. She won that traditional Labor seat with a swing of almost 20%. And while a fair proportion of that swing could be attributed to the defeat of the Keating government in that election and a large anti-Labor government swing at that time, that's probably accounts for half the swing. But the final 10% of that very massive swing was over and above that experienced by electorates throughout the state. Ms. Hanson served one term in the Australian Parliament. She was defeated at the subsequent federal election. But the issues that she pursued tapped a very real vein in large segments of the Australian community. And her issues were around, certainly, programs targeting Aboriginal disadvantage, but more broadly, anything that was seen to be against the immediate economic or other sort of conservative interests of good white middle or lower middle class communities. So she was anti-immigration. She was anti-multiculturalism. She was anti-economic rationalism, though I think she'd probably struggle to explain actually what economic rationalism meant. And she certainly was very much in favour of economic protectionism, the re-establishment of tariffs and the broad set of measures to support Australian industry against international competition within the Australian domestic marketplace. In many ways, the same sort of economic philosophy you hear from Bob Katter, currently in the Australian Federal Parliament. At the time, her sentiments did strike quite a chord with the community, particularly in Queensland, but more broadly than Queensland. The strength of that was then revealed at a Queensland state election a few years later, where One Nation, the party spawned by Pauline Hanson, received around about a quarter of all the votes cast in that Queensland election, and some 11 One Nation candidates were elected to the 89-member Queensland Parliament. In the subsequent 10 years or so that flowed after that, One Nation from that high point relatively rapidly faded. It lost progressively all its members in the Queensland Parliament, though its final member was able to hold on for some two or three elections before finally losing a seat in North Queensland. The party briefly held a Senate position in the state of Queensland. That position was then lost in election around about 2004. And similar parties which were spawned in other parts of Australia were never quite as successful, though a fellow by the name of Graham Campbell held a seat in Western Australia under the banner of Australia First, which had broadly similar philosophical views to that of Hanson and One Nation. In my view, the appeal of Pauline Hanson was more around an appeal to certainties of an old Australia. It was an appeal to sentiment as much as it was appeal to maybe underlying sentiments of racism in the Australian community, though that no doubt had a element of support for her. It was the idea which Australia had been founded upon in some ways as a new nation at the time of federation, the concept of white Australia, of our protection by a great and powerful friend, Great Britain, and then following the Second World War, the United States, and the need to align ourselves very closely with the foreign policy of the great and powerful friend. And importantly, economic protectionism, Australian manufacturing industry behind high tariff walls, and the idea of centralised wage fixing and the conciliation and arbitration system as a means of settling industrial disputes, which was really probably the one one of a few very innovative notions of the foundation of the Australian nation, the idea of this being an arbitrated way of resolving industrial conflict, which was racking most of the world, or certainly the Western world, during the late 1880s through to the early 1900s. So, in my view, economic Hansenism is about a call to the idea of Fortress Australia, protectionism, keeping out competition so that Australian industries can flourish. It's a flawed view, and it's been a largely discredited view in terms of the very widespread and, in world terms, quite remarkable economic success that Australia has enjoyed throughout the last 2 to 3 decades, from the following on the reforms of the Hawke-Keating era, and which has put Australia in good stead through the global financial crisis. And this was a commitment to openness, to competition, to productivity growth, to Australia being outward looking in terms of its economic stance, at least, if not more broadly in terms of its outlook, rather than inward looking and attempting to build walls around particular communities or industries. So it's a completely different outlook to that being promoted by so-called economic Hansenism. The current battlegrounds for economic Hansenism is the position of the Australian banks. The federal opposition, Mr. Hockey, the federal treasurer, has promoted a so-called 9-point plan to bring forward competition into the banks. This has been largely dismissed by the government as an attempt to, one, play at populism in terms of the ease of bashing banks in terms of garnering general public support, but secondly, and more dangerously, being a walking away from this bipartisan commitment that Australia has witnessed largely, not on every issue, but largely over the last 2 to 3 decades in terms of its economic direction. So economic Hansenism is a throwback to Australia's recent historical past, but in a deeper sense it is a throwback to this classic old argument between free trade and protectionism, which has been a constant struggle in terms of the underlying political and economic discourse of Australia well over the last 100 to 150 years. It's like many of the debates we have today, their roots can be founded in Australian history. Larissa, do you think Australia is moving back to economic Hansenism? And if so, would it be a bad thing, I wonder?
Well, I wanted to actually ask you a question about this Hansenism, maybe not so much on the issue of economics, but more broadly. I mean, in that history you gave us of Pauline Hanson's emergence onto the political stage, you know, she was originally a member of the Liberal Party and, as you said, got disendorsed and formed her own political movement on the back of that. There was a narrative that emerged during the Howard era that actually sort of said that he reverted to Hansenism in a broader social or political context around issues with Aboriginal people and border protection. And I was wondering what your views were about that comparison between Howard's stance on some of those issues and to what extent you think he did sort of pander to that same crowd, or is that an unfair assessment of the way that he approached those policies?
I think John Howard, an astute politician that he was, understood that the sentiments which were associated with Pauline Hanson were quite broadly held, by no means necessarily a majority of Australians, but a significant segment. And we had a replay, really, of the same issues during the last federal election a few months back now, and this focus on the battle for Western Sydney and around asylum seekers and a range of other issues. At the time, Howard did not intervene strongly in relation to Hanson's arguments, if you could call them arguments. While he said he didn't agree with a range of the things that she was saying, he basically tipped his hat to her in terms of her entitlement to make a case, and that it reflected a fair bit of commonly held views. I suppose that's a fair enough assessment. The second part of the argument then wasn't engaged with. He didn't actually terribly put any energy into tackling the arguments which were being advanced, shooting down the straw men in terms of the way in which Aboriginal Australians are treated, the benefits of multiculturalism in terms of Australian society, both economic and more broadly, probably only in terms of economic policy was there some defence mounted of economic rationalism, and economic rationalism decoded really means throwing away the false hope around protectionism, tariff walls, and the like as the basis of providing for living standards. So there was a bit of refutal on that. But if one criticises John Howard on it, and I think one can, you can make an equal criticism, I think, of leaders that have followed John Howard. Both Kevin Rudd, to some extent, and Julia Gillard, maybe more directly in the recent election campaign, again, gave a nod in the direction of the sentiments in the Australian community, which by no means have gone away since Pauline Hanson's time, of people being fearful of change, being fearful of their perceptions of their way of life and their living standards and what they enjoy being placed under pressure by a range of things, particularly in terms of population growth around migration, but also this mean-spirited sentiment that somehow tackling Aboriginal disadvantage pulls down the rest of the community, or was a waste of money, or somehow was racist in a reverse way because the same programs tackling disadvantage aren't available to other communities. Now, all of these things don't stand up to any shred of scrutiny, but it seems a lot easier to acknowledge them than to actually then take on the argument and try to explain the things factually and calmly and rationally. I know it's a difficult task to do because, it's much easier to work with existing perceptions and to reinforce them than it is to change them. It's a much harder political task to do, a public policy task to change perceptions. So from John Howard through to Julia Gillard, there is a considerable tension in terms of the way in which these issues are handled.
Yeah, and this point you make about, the extent to which you actually take on that sense of economic fragility that people feel they have, etc. I mean, in some ways, that's precisely some of the issues that have come out in relation to hockey's observations and suggestions about how to change the banking sector. And I was wondering, just using that as an example, the extent to which you think he's actually motivated by a broader political agenda, or do you think there is an element of popularism that it's, a lot of people, struggle with interest rates, they've got mortgages, they're small businesses, with debt to manage, they see the banks with big profits, they're kind of an easy target in a way if you don't kind of get in and explain what's going on there. Do you think there's an element of popularism about what he's doing with the banks?
Well, there's more than an element of popularism. It's totally about popularism, as the truth be told. The Australian banking sector, by world terms, is a well-performed sector. It survived in very good shape through the global financial crisis, when comparable countries had a crisis. I must, often misused term, but in this case, a genuine crisis in terms of their financial sector and the stability of the banking system. Australia did not have that, and that was through a good regulatory structure, good oversight, capital adequacy requirements, and in fairness, well-run, properly risk-managed banks. So good architecture and well-led banks in this country led to Australia not experiencing anything like the problems we saw in other parts of the world. Now, making that a point and saying that Australia is well served by its banks is not an easy argument really to make in terms of popular perception. None of us, it's like paying taxes. I don't particularly appreciate paying my mortgage. I don't like it when interest rates go up. No one does. But the truth of the matter is that the rate of return in terms of the investments that banks have, that is, if you compare what you get for your money in terms of being an investor in the Australian banking system compared to other segments of the economy, it is not a massively profitable sector. It is a profitable sector, and they're big businesses, and they make very large profits through being large. But in terms of the funds invested, they're not in the super profit league. There's certainly nothing like the resources sector or elements of the resources sector, which have been in the super profit league in recent times. That said, that's a difficult argument to get through. It's much easier to do a bit of a belt. People will respond on the whole probably a bit more. And of course, there is a whole range of banking practices which are annoying, and more than annoying. The level of how much fees are a genuine recovery of true cost of providing a service, and how much of a fee is a revenue raising measure, be it ATM fees, fees around dishonoured checks. I mean, the whole raft of bank fees, which are sometimes brought into question. So there are issues, but very much one would have to say on the margins in the way in which Australian banks operate. On the whole, in terms of the big picture items, it's well run and it is not excessively profitable. But in terms of big numbers, it certainly looks that way to ordinary people.
Got a couple of questions that flow from what you've just said. In sort of appreciating the popularism around hockey's position, what do you think of the way that Gillard's responded to it?
Well, I think, interestingly, Gillard's response has been to a different audience than the bulk of the population. The audience that she's been interested to in responding to Joe Hockey really has been the leadership of Australian business. It's the economic elite, if you like, rather than the broader population. She did not so much tip her lid in this occasion to popular sentiment. She was dismissive of hockey and saw a weakness in terms of the economic credibility of the opposition, and decided to go down that particular line. So, and she didn't then confuse the message by saying, well, I feel your pain, but she just went to, no, this simply does not make sense. And in fact, it's dangerous in terms of Australia's prosperity to get into this particular space. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable position for it to take. It says, interestingly, not terribly consistent, because there's a whole range of other issues where one could simply engage or attempt to engage on the substance of the argument without the nod to popular sentiment, asylum seekers being one, migration, a range of population issues, cost of living issues, where certainly the government does acknowledge and nod towards sentiment and try to manage it. Now, of course, it has to, but it's not completely consistent. I suppose it is a bit of a smorgasbord. She's picking and choosing her issues, but in this one, her audience has been the business and economic elite and not the broader population.
The other issue that you raised in your commentary just then was the difference between the Liberal Party approach, or coalition approach, to the mining tax, the resource super profits tax, and then Hockey's position with the banks. It's not easy for me to see how you reconcile those two positions. Is there a logic to this that I'm missing?
I think you'd have to be looking, in Sherlock Holmes-like way to see a consistent logic in it. I mean, clearly the argument put forward by the Conservatives in terms of the mining industry is that its national prosperity is dependent on the sector being successful to change the taxation regime so that mining companies, or those in particular parts of the mining industry at least, were paying a greater proportion of their revenue to tax in a context of very large profits, which are historically large, which can fairly be described as super, that is, in extraordinary levels of profitability. That, according to the Conservatives, was bad policy and a risk, and yet the banking sector, which again in numerical terms makes large profits, but in terms of return on investment, nothing like the same sort of level of return than you're seeing in the resources sector, then for Mr. Hockey, apparently, well, that's a issue inviting regulatory reform, competition reforms, suggestions that the ordinary community shouldn't be paying anything more when banks are so profitable. There is, of course, no consistency in the two approaches. Interestingly, I saw a public opinion survey indicating that before there'd been any debate on it, but a starting point, something like about 60 or plus percent of the population would support a super profit tax on banks, which indicates that there is a sentiment here which Mr. Hockey has tapped into, but no consistency in terms of the position with the mining companies. I suppose it could have been simply the proximity of the election campaign, which might have accounted for a bit of that. And, of course, the simple proposition that if the government is saying A, then a Tony Abbott opposition, almost as a matter of principle, will always say B.
Well, sadly, that's all we've got time for.
Well, thank you, Larissa, and thanks to all our listeners here on 2SER to maintain the rage, and hopefully you'll be able to join us for future shows.